You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, presented by Trainer Road, cycling's most effective training tool.
I want to be the title sponsor. What's it going to cost?
I think around 10 million.
Yeah, I that's a bit out of my budget.
I have the impression that we are in the place where we have to be now.
Greg had a really bad back all last week, so we caught up on your podcast with me giving him a back massage and him listening to you guys.
That's a wonderful image.
With exclusive interviews and the best analysis on two wheels, this is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm joined by Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Rob Hatch.
Hello, Richard.
You heard a little jingle there at the start of the podcast for our new sponsor, Trainer Road. You'll be hearing a little bit more about that partnership in this podcast and in the weeks and months to come. This sponsorship is going to be more than just a jingle at the start of the podcast, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Effectively, we have attracted some sponsorship, but we have to work hard to justify and earn that sponsorship in order to keep the podcast free for our listeners. We're literally putting in legwork to make this work, aren't we?
And Rob, I'm delighted to say, will be joining us in this.
It sounds like I've just been roped into it to make you two look better so I can finish bottom.
But we're very grateful to Trainer Road for sponsoring us. We've got lots to talk about, obviously, the Vuelta finishing, Tour of Britain finishing, World Championships coming up. Got a little interview with Taylor Finney, which I did with him at the Tour of Britain start in Edinburgh, just before he pulled out the race, actually. Didn't finish it, but he's coming back from a very serious injury. So we'll hear from Taylor Finney, and we'll also hear from Ian Boswell, the Team Sky rider, who has just finished his first Grand Tour and has signed for another 2 years with Team Sky. And then in the final part, Lionel and I will be film critics. He'll be Barry Norman to my Mark Kermode as we discuss the programme, the new Lance Armstrong movie, which we attended a screening of last week with David Miller, who was involved as a consultant on the film, and he spoke a little bit afterwards about the making of the film, and I thought quite interesting some of the things he said, but of course the film itself was fascinating to watch. Lionel, a little roundup, what's been happening in the last week?
The Vuelta a España has reached its dramatic conclusion. One of the all-time great turnarounds in terms of the conclusion of a Grand Tour. Tom Dumoulin and Fabio Aru were locked together until the penultimate stage. We'll talk about this in more depth, but if you are unaware of what happened to there was a spectacular turnaround on that final mountain stage, and Fabio Aru clinched his first Grand Tour, and Tom Dumoulin sadly suffered a bit of a collapse and lost his podium place, not just the leader's red jersey. Then there was the Tour of Britain, of course. Lots of people will have been paying attention to that. Won for the second time in his career by Edvald Boasenhagen. Held off Wout Poels of Team Sky almost at sort of arm's length, really, throughout the whole week. Boasenhagen rode a very canny race, really, over the lumpy, grippy roads of Britain. Before we move on, I should also just say that we had a competition a couple of weeks ago to win a signed copy of Sean Kelly's autobiography, Hunger, in hardback. Very few of those still remain. Even fewer of them have been signed by the man himself. Two copies will be given, to people who answered the question correctly. The question was, who were the other two riders to finish on the podium of the 1988 Vuelta, which Sean Kelly won? The answer is Raymond Dietzen of Germany and Anselmo Fuerte of Spain. And the two winners are picked at random, Matt Harrop and Alison Boast. So if Matt and Alison could get in touch with us, either on Twitter, cycling_podcast, or by emailing us at cyclingpodcast@outlook.com, we'll arrange to get those books sent out.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Join us on Twitter and Facebook. Just search online for the Cycling Podcast.
So, Tour of Britain, first of all, Rob, you were commentating on it. It was, as ever, well attended. I think the crowds were big. We had Orla Shinawee last week, who'd been at the start of the Tour of Britain. I think she felt the crowds at the team presentation and at the start of the opening stage were not great. But I think out on the road, the crowds were as big as ever. I was at the start in Edinburgh midweek. I have to say the crowds in Edinburgh were very small at the start. And sometimes that's the case in a city. I think in towns, if had it started in Peebles just down the road, I think it would have been a bigger crowd there. But out on the course, out on the road, the crowds were very thick indeed. And the racing, was it good? Did it live up to that sort of interest?
Racing was fantastic. It was open all week, right until the last couple of days, really. I mean, if a time bonus had been taken on by Wout Poels in London on Sunday, then there might have been a bit more excitement there, but we have movements on the podium, even on the last stage, with Owain Dool, best British rider of the week, putting in a fantastic performance for Team Wiggins. With regards to the crowds, I was absolutely mesmerised by the amount of people on the side of the road. Even looking to my home area, if you like, East Lancashire, and seeing the town where I used to go to sixth form in Clitheroe, full of people. Stories from my dad, who was at the start, saying that he just could not believe the amount of people at the side of the road turning up in a joyous mood. People who'd never even been interested in cycling before. And I think that's one of the great things that the Tour of Britain is doing. It's bringing a lot more people to the sport, new viewers to the sport, and people who just enjoy showing off their region as well, even if they haven't got an interest in the two-wheel racing. There were a lot of that on the road, though. Wales was fantastic. We already knew that we were going to have a good race, I think, when it started. We had a very close sprint on the first day. Elia Viviani showing that he could beat Mark Cavendish and Andre Greipel. And I think with that, with a further discussion, which I'm sure you'll carry on next week, World Championships, he's got to be one of the favourites up there now. In the end, took three stages. Edvard Boasenhagen finished second on two stages, and I think for me where he won the Tour of Britain was on Hartside Fell on the uphill finish. He beat a lot of fantastic climbers on that day. He was well backed up in the first half of the race by his team MTN Quebeca, but I think they showed that they were a little tired in the second half and he had to look after himself. I wondered, like many, whether he was throwing it away on the road to Ipswich when he attacked. But
that was extraordinary.
That was Nottingham, pardon me. Nottingham.
Yeah, when he was really isolated at that point and doing a lot of work on the front, and you just thought he's making a big mistake here. He's leaving himself open to some kind of attack. He dropped back and then launched an attack himself.
No, with the type of rider he is, the fast man, he's always going to be up there in the end, certainly much more than Wout Poels. There wasn't enough terrain for me for Wout Poels to make those seconds up. So even though he had a bit more of a slender lead going into the stage in Nottingham, he didn't need to attack when he did. And for me, the only thing that he was going to do was lose the race from there, wasting his energy. We saw the team car come up as well, perhaps telling him to stop having a go, to just think about it a little more. But he obviously knew what he felt like. He knew that he had the legs. He couldn't win the stage on at the end of the day, which I think that's what he was trying to do. He was trying to crown the win with a stage win. But you have to say that he's certainly back in business, isn't he? Shown that this year.
And presumably Boasenhagen, our favourite for the World Championship as well. It's interesting you mentioned Viviani as a favourite. The question always with the Italian team, of course, is how will the politics work? Who will be the protected rider? Viviani is a fascinating sprinter to watch. He won the first stage of the Giro this year in similar fashion. He appears very late, doesn't he? And it's almost the sort of track background he has. He's a very experienced track rider. You often see that on the track, that a sprinter will lunge very late, will come very late for the you're not somebody who's going to go with 100-150 meters to go, and he just sort of emerges.
Well, we had two or three photo finishes this week, I think, proved that, didn't they? Certainly on the last day we had all the argy-bargy with the elbow into the barriers, and that, I'm not sure what you guys thought about that, but Greipel coming across his line, for anybody that didn't see it, Viviani was trying to come around him on the left-hand side, but Greipel sort of closing the door on him, if you were in the final sprint in London. Greipel won it on the road, but he was later disqualified, and Viviani, though, did look to be timing his assault to perfection again on the line. He was in the end given that stage because Greipel was relegated. But I'd be interested to see what you guys thought on that. For me, I would absolve Greipel of any blame because I don't think he did it intentionally. He's not that sort of sprinter. He is the gentleman sprinter after all. But I would say that in the cold light of day, he would look at that video and say, well, if I were Viviani in that situation, I'd have been disappointed not to be given the win as well. But it'd be interesting to know what you guys thought.
Well, he sprinted in a straight line. It's just that his straight line happened to be cutting off Viviani. I mean, it's a real... it's a difficult one, isn't it? I mean, you're supposed to hold your line, and really, he did that. I mean, the fact that he was sprinting over towards the barriers meant that Viviani's route through was completely barred. But having said that, what struck me was that when they came together, just what great bike handling the pair of them showed to stay upright, because that could have
the sprint as well.
Exactly. I mean, it was I think it was probably the correct decision, but it was a little bit harsh on Greipel. I mean, it wasn't like he moved across to specifically shut the door. That looked to me from a long way out the line he was choosing to sprint down. but you know, that's what he said as well. And it's difficult. It's probably best to give him the benefit of the doubt on that one. But he lost the win. But then, having said that, the photo finish prior, you know, I'm not sure the picture was conclusive.
It reminded me a bit of a referee who sort of evens things up by incorrectly giving a referee to one team and then evening up a bit in the second half by giving giving him a penalty to one team and then evens up by giving a non-penalty to the other team. And I felt that the previous day Viviani had it was given to Greipel. And you know, we mentioned I think last week on the podcast, a team like Lotto Soudal didn't want to come to the Tour of Britain and go home without a stage win. I think a stage win was very important to them. So they got their stage win, and Greipel lost a stage win and then got the tube to the airport by all accounts. Owen Dool, you mentioned Owen Dool, and we're getting the pronunciation of his name correct, I think, there. Rob, he rode extremely well, finished third. A rider who I had always sort of categorised as a sprinter and a track rider, very good team pursuer. But there he's finished third overall, and he was up there in all the sprints, but he finished third overall in a race that is a bit more of an all-rounders race. Maybe not so much this year as it was last year, but finished third overall in that company behind Wout Poels and Edvald Boasenhagen. Very impressive.
Very impressive, given the fact that he hasn't done too much of that type of racing on the road as well. He's 22 now, I think. He's going to go to Rio next year, ride on the track.
Also turned down a contract Europe car this year, yeah. Of course, didn't he?
I know that he was interested in going to the continent, exactly. Turned down that contract, stayed with Team Wiggins. I think the interesting thing with regards to his signature is going to be at the end of next season, after the Olympics, if he decides to dedicate more of his career to the role, which I think, looking at this result, if he's interested in it, he should do. Very talented. And those people who know much more about rider development and coaching and where you can go than we do, I'm sure be looking at him now and thinking, right, what can we do? Can we get him to lose a bit of weight? Can he climb better? Can he time trial? That's the other question as well. And you'd hazard a guess that he can do, given his discipline on the track. It's going to be a really, really interesting one to see where he goes.
He looks quite like Rob Hatch, doesn't he, Owen Dool? Do you not think? Do you not think, Lionel?
Yeah, I can definitely see the resemblance.
I've never seen us in the same room.
Never seen you in the same room. I have heard you commentating on him, though.
If you put a helmet and glasses on, Rob, I mean, almost
well,
a spitting.
We will be doing that for our forthcoming Trainer Road collaboration. Now, listen, let's wrap up on the Tour, because we've got a very exciting Vuelta to talk about.
We have, yeah, but I was just going to pick up on what you said, Richard, about the difference between last year's race and this year's race. It was a lot more sprinty, not just because the course was more kind of, you know, it was more tailored for that, but also because the strength of the sprinters that were here, Viviani and Greipel, of course. Team Wiggins, they had a real interest to try and bring it back together. While he was still in the race, Mark Cavendish, he crashed out, hit a car parked on the edge of the road in the sort of crosswinds. That was a bit of an unfortunate incident. They didn't have a lot of luck because Peter Vakoc, who won the second stage, also crashed out while in the yellow jersey. So sort of honourable mention to him. But it was very sprinty, and the stages weren't as dynamic as perhaps they were last year. I remember the stage that went over the Chilterns where Alex Dowsett and Mathijs
Brandley
and somebody else got away. It was a Madison Genesis rider. I can't remember his name, unfortunately. But there was a lot of sort of quite formulaic racing. You'd expect, the British teams really got up the road in numbers, as well as, honorary Irishman, genuine Irishman, Conor Dunn, from my neck of the woods. I actually raced against him at Hillingdon once. I know, rolling your eyes.
He was seven at the time.
I think he was a bit older than seven, but I, in the official results, finished ahead of him.
I think we should give one quick mention to One Pro Cycling and Pete Williams. Pete Williams Merckx, or Pete the Cannibal Williams, we should call him, after he took the intermediate sprint and the King of the Mountains jerseys. One Pro Cycling attempting to move up next year. They showed us on Twitter, didn't they, the photographs of their application to be Pro Continental next year. Well, I'm not sure about the finances and everything else. I've heard that's in good order, but on the road, they're certainly very interesting. Biał Błocki, the Polish time trial champion, riding brilliantly to lead him in and do the work. Chris Opie was good as well, helping him out in that King of the Mountains before he crashed on the airfield the other day. Pete Williams, fantastic ride, and One Pro Cycling doing themselves proud.
And I saw my old mucker, James McCallum, Scottish sort of retired rider now, has become their DS. Spoke to him in Edinburgh, and he's full-time DS with them now, sort of meteoric rise as a director, and he was always a very kind of assertive rider who really could read a race, James. So I think he's destined for good things as a director sportif. Let's hear from Taylor Finney, who I spoke to at the stage start in Edinburgh. The American rider had a terrible crash last June at the US National Championships. A vehicle was involved. He smashed his leg. He's got horrific scars on his leg. It did look, I think, for a lot of us watching from the outside, that he might not come back. But he did come back, finally, at the Tour of Utah, and he won a stage there, which was quite a dream return. It wasn't the strongest field, but nevertheless, good to get a win. He's back. He didn't finish Tour of Britain to go and prepare for the World Championships. And let's hear from him now. How are you doing? I mean, you're sort of properly into your comeback now. How are you feeling?
Pretty good. Still have to stay on top of my therapy and stuff for my knee every day, so it's long days. You know, we wake up early and long stages, and then right off the stage, you know, I've got to take care of myself to make sure I can finish the next day. So it's a lot, but it's, you know, it just is what it is.
What does that involve exactly?
We have a PT, like a physio here, and she works, you know, to make sure that my pelvis is stable and just that nothing's flaring up, mostly on my left side, that would cause any issues. That's maybe 30 minutes to an hour, and then I go from there to a massage, and then the massage is pretty specific for an hour plus. And then it's pretty much immediately to dinner, and then I try to unwind after that.
Are you, I mean, you've won a race already, you've had a great successful comeback already, but are you enjoying being back? Because there must have been a time when you're out, and a lot of athletes who are out for a long time, when they come back, they say they have a sort of different attitude towards it. Has your attitude towards it changed at all?
Yeah, it's definitely different. I noticed that I think a lot differently in the race, kind of weigh risks a little bit differently, feel a lot calmer actually when it starts to get stressful, a lot more alert, kind of awake sort of to what is happening around me and all the decisions that I can make in order for myself to stay safe, and then also, you know, what I need to do to be in the front, when I need to be in the front, and following that instinct, you know, that grows over the years. Sometimes it feels like, oh, back to work a little bit, you know, a stage like yesterday, a stage like today, where you're just riding along, it's not so hard, and it's like a long time on the bike. It's one of those days everybody talks about having to unplug their brain, but that's nearly impossible for me. So it's interesting because you're surrounded by 115 other people, but it's a lot of alone time, you know.
And physically, are you different at all? I mean, you lost a lot of muscle, obviously, but are you pretty much the same shape? Are you going to become the same sort of rider again?
I think so. I mean, I did lose some muscle, but I do produce similar power numbers. Maybe a little bit less explosive, but that might work towards my advantage, you know, because then I can't waste those little spurts, you know, I have to save them. So you just try to take what you have.
And I know that you kept yourself busy when you were out with flying and painting and things. Are you keeping those things going at all?
Yeah, it's hard when you're training a lot, and especially when you're racing and traveling. Keep a journal with me and do some doodling, some writing here and there. I was talking to Peter Kenna about this yesterday. You know, the main drawback, I think, for most of us as cyclists is that it takes so much out of you that you can't really be yourself most of the time, you know, because you're just so tired. You can ride a bike really well, but then personally, social life sort of suffers. Not that it suffers, but you just feel like you can't really, really be as much of yourself as you want to, so that's something that you really need in order to make art, is that you have that, you know, that personal.
Might you publish this stuff or put out in the public domain at some point?
Maybe. It's not, I don't really do it for that reason, you know. So I do it for people that are around me. I do it a lot for myself, mainly for myself. And then, you know, it's kind of one of those things where, like, when I die, you can see it. But I don't know. If I get more comfortable with the idea of that, maybe. But we'll see.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, brought to you by British Eurosport, the home of cycling.
Thank you very much to British Eurosport for their ongoing sponsorship of the podcast as well. They are broadcasting the World Championships coming up in Richmond, Virginia. And I think you're involved in that, Rob. The team time trial is on British Eurosport this Sunday.
Kicks off 6:30 p.m. on British Eurosport. It's the team time trial from Richmond. Brian Smith will be alongside me for that. And afterwards as well, stay tuned at 9 p.m. we'll have an hour-long highlight of the Women's Team Time Trial Championships as well.
And look out for the World Championships all week on British Eurosport. So the Vuelta, the final Grand Tour of the season, has finished. Fabio Aru of Italy was the winner. But the story really was the collapse on the penultimate day of Tom Dumoulin, the big Dutch rider, 24 years old, the revelation of the race. He crashed out of the Tour de France, of course, and I think nobody, even his own team, expected him to be a contender at the Vuelta. That was reflected in the team that they sent to the Vuelta, which was built largely around John Degenkolb, who won the final stage into Madrid. And that lack of team support for Tom Dumoulin when the race was in the mountains perhaps was telling in the end. The penultimate day, early on, a 38-man group went clear. There were no Giant Alpecin riders in it, and I think it's easy with hindsight to say that was an error, but it was an error. I think Fabio Aru had two Astana teammates up there who were able to help him later on once he distanced Dumoulin. He also had Mikel Landa, a very strong climber, who perhaps made a real difference in driving the group clear once Dumoulin had been distanced. Dumoulin played that down at the end. He felt that even if he'd got back on, he'd have been dropped again on the final climb, because he was dropped on the penultimate climb on a tough day. So he felt that it was just in the end what cost him the victory was fatigue. But was the team responsible as well, Lionel?
It's harsh to say, but they didn't play the cards particularly well on that stage. The difficulty for Dumoulin was that he had no help whatsoever, really, from any of the riders around him once he was dropped, and he had to do a lot of that chasing on his own. And he got agonisingly close to getting back. Yes, he probably would have got dropped again, but that was not least because of the amount of work he'd put in to try and get back on terms. I think he got it down to sort of, you know, 10, 15 seconds again before blowing, really. He blew up. The problem was that none of the riders with him had any incentive to help other than to work over Astana. And there had been too much kind of, you know, speculation that there might be a bit of a combine, because Astana, not necessarily the most popular team in the peloton. And in a way, that kind of counter went against them, because nobody wanted to be seen to, you know, work against Astana and help Tom Dumoulin win at Fabio Aru's expense. But had the stage victory still been up for grabs, then riders who'd been dropped by that Aru-Landa group may well have helped Dumoulin, because there would have been something in it for them, potentially. But because the stage had gone all, you know, up the road, Ruben Plaza had been out on his own for about 6 hours. I think he must have set off before everyone else.
Out in the front since the Tour de France.
Yeah, he attacked in Gap over the Col de Monts, and he's been riding on his own ever since. We've only just caught up with him. But because the stage had gone, you know, that's where, you know, yes, it's very tempting to say this is two separate races here, one for the stage win and one for the overall. But actually, you know, there's such subtle forces at play. And had they all been together, it might have been different. Somebody else might have thought, well, I could get back on here and potentially win the stage. But as it was, Dumoulin was left on his own. Whether you can blame Giant Alpecin for that is debatable. We didn't see them reacting to the move that went up the road at the start, but they weren't necessarily expecting to be defending the red jersey through this race.
It's very, very unusual to see the leader of a Grand Tour on his own like that, and with no help at all, none of his own teammates and no one else helping him. It's incredibly unusual to see that.
Yeah, it's bizarre, but I think to understand it, we're probably better off rewinding 2 or 3 years to Giant Alpecin and to give another illustration of the situation they find themselves in is have a look at Orica GreenEdge as well, because they're two teams with very similar projects. They started off with stage wins in mind, maybe the old classic win, good sprinters, good lead out trains, teams that have started out certainly with a budget that is dwarfed by the size of Astana, Sky and all the big GC teams. You've got to include Movistar in that, because they pump a lot of money into their team as well. And as Lionel said, they didn't expect themselves to be in that situation defending the red jersey. The GC with Orica GreenEdge, we've seen with Esteban Chavez sort of coming of age, mid-20s now, riding fantastically well in the first week, and latterly with the headline one, which is Tom Dumoulin of the Netherlands for Giant Alpecin. These guys don't have teams around them to look after that. They're not versed in that way of riding, even though they're fantastically gifted riders. The directors on the teams are used to riding in a certain way as well, and The interesting thing now is how they approach it, both of them, and I would bring Chavez into this equation as well during the winter, how those teams maybe think about, okay, these guys are coming of age now, they're coming to the right point, we started with them as young riders and we always had this long-term GC prospect and opportunity. And it's not just with Dumoulin and Chavez, Orica Greenedge, you've got it with the Yateses as well, and I know that there are two or three American climbers in the last two or three seasons that have been signed by a giant Alpecin with the same idea as well. How they sort of step it up a notch, change their way of riding, and do they sacrifice other things? That's something to think about over the winter, I think. But to finish and round out the point, I'd absolve them of blame completely, because that's just not how they came into this race trying to ride.
Giant Alpecin put out a release on Monday which talked a little bit about Dumoulin's ride at the Vuelta and what the team's approach and expectations had been going into it. How he's developed. I think they were preempting a lot of questions about, you know, the fact that this big, tall, quite broad-shouldered rider had emerged as a Grand Tour contender over the 3 weeks of the Vuelta. You know, fair play to them. That it was a very interesting, very detailed bit of writing. I tweeted it on Monday. Well worth a read. And you know, they spoke about Dumoulin's development as a rider and his transformation from a pure time trialist into somebody who can climb. In terms of Grand Tours, they said that the problem that he's had in the past has been inconsistency, which is very common, which holds a lot of people back from contending in Grand Tours. But what we saw at the Vuelta was not inconsistency. We saw great consistency. What we saw in the end was fatigue. It wasn't a bad day that he had on the penultimate day. It was a bad day, but the bad day owed to fatigue rather than erratic form. It was just, as he said, one day too far for him. And it was funny because the previous day to Avila, with the little cobbled climb to the finish, he dropped Aru up there, and at that point he doubled his lead from 3 seconds to 6 seconds. It looked as if the Vuelta would be Dumoulin's, and I thought as well, and I still probably maintain that, you know, I feel sometimes the role of the team is overstated, but Aru is somebody who, to me, flatters to deceive a little bit. He's not, I don't think he's going to go on to become a multiple Grand Tour winner. I think he needs that strong team around him, and I think he is found wanting at times and will continue to be so.
Yeah, I was going to say, you didn't get to the end of the Vuelta and think, wow, Fabio Aru has really pulled off an amazing Grand Tour win there. He was good in the mountains, he wasn't spectacular. He won it really in the time trial by limiting his losses to Dumoulin.
10th in time trial. I mean, that his time trial was the performance that, as you say, probably won him the Vuelta. And it surprised me. It was for a rider who seems sometimes to lack power, it was a very impressive performance.
It was. And, I mean, people were talking about Dumoulin possibly taking 3 minutes out of Aru. I mean, that always looked very ambitious, particularly so deep into the race. But Aru rode, I'd say, above himself on that day to give himself the best possible chance. He looked ragged on that stage to Avila. He was all over the bike. He got a bit of a push in the back from a teammate at one point, which had
Leon Sanchez,
had the commissaires taken the letter of the UCI rules to heart, they may well have penalised him 10 seconds. Probably wouldn't have made any difference whatsoever to the final result. But interesting little side note nonetheless. And Dumoulin, you're right, he just ran out of legs one day too far. And I think we overestimate, sometimes the capacity of riders to keep performing at identical levels day after day after day. And eventually, you know, we've seen it, I suppose, with Geraint Thomas. People are asking, why is he pulled out of the Worlds when it looks like the course might be ideally suited to him? Well, he's just ridden an incredibly hard Tour de France and a Vuelta, and it's probably just all got too much, and he feels legless. And you know, that was what happened to Dumoulin. But Aru, it would have been really interesting had Astana not been quite so strong as they were. I mean, they were all over it. They did ride a good race, particularly as they were down a man after Nibali's disqualification in the first week. But that was a team victory. I know, you know, Richie made the point about team play being perhaps overstated, but in this case, I think, you know, Aru needed that team to get that win done.
And Laurens ten Dam, the Team Lotto NL Jumbo rider, made the point on Twitter. He seemed to be being quite critical of Giant Alpecin for leaving Dumoulin so isolated, but he did also make the point that the sort of money that Astana pay their riders is the total team budget for Giant Alpecin. There is a gulf there, and for all the, whenever Astana perform well, in particular as they did at the Giro, there are always questions, there's always a bit of suspicion. People forget that these are really good riders, and they are paid a lot of money to ride as they did at the Vuelta and at the Giro.
I've got a ridiculously good team. Dario Cataldo is at Sky for the last couple of years as well. Didn't really enjoy it too much there, but he rode well for them. Remember in the Giro a couple of years ago when the plan went all wrong and he had to take up the mantle. What about Mikel Landa? You know, off to Sky, we think. We're still waiting for confirmation on that, but it's probably a good job for Aru, although it probably didn't seem like it on the day that he won that big stage in the mountains, because he got that out of the way. He got his little bit of, let's say, his rebellion out of the way. He got his big win, and after that he did settle down and work for Aru, and I would say that we wouldn't have been talking about a first Sardinian Grand Tour winner if Mikel Landa hadn't got his stage win out of the way, hadn't ridden a fantastic race, because there'd have been something inside, that bit of pride that he would have wanted to ride more for himself.
Something inside so strong.
I'm sure so, yeah.
Listen, Dumoulin, he was bitterly disappointed. You know, if you'd offered him sixth place in the Vuelta at the start of the race, he'd probably have bitten your hand off for that, but he was bitterly disappointed to lose the race. I was thinking about, what does he do now? You know, the Tour de France is obvious, but if I was him, I would be waiting for all the courses to be announced for the three Grand Tours. Just pick the one that suits you best. Pick the one with the most time trialling and the least climbing.
Absolutely, but you know, riders so often sort of pick the race based on the name and the time of year rather than necessarily the course. But particularly as the Vuelta course comes out quite late, doesn't it? Not until January time. The Giro will be out in December and the Tour in October. Yeah, that's one of the quirks of cycling, isn't it? You don't necessarily know. And let's face it, you know, he went into that race. I think one of his sports directors tweeted that they were enjoying a beer and something to eat, sat in the sunshine in the garden 6 days before the Vuelta. Had Tom Dumoulin looked at the start of the year for a Grand Tour that would suit him most, he would probably have picked the Vuelta third. So, but you're absolutely right. Take a look at the courses, you know, see how he dovetails with the other riders in his team, because they are still a sprint focused team. They're going to have to change that. They might have to recruit some riders who can give a bit more support in the mountains.
They're expensive, those riders, and they probably don't have the budget for it.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, I think we, during the tour in one of our Kilometre Zeros, Andrew McQuaid, the agent, said that climbing domestiques are, you know, pound for pound, you know, they are expensive per results, because they don't get personal results, but they are the diesels that do all of this racing, and they command big fees, and they probably are beyond Giant Alpecin.
Well, listen, one of the quietly strong performers in the Vuelta was Ian Boswell, the Team Sky rider, American rider, riding his first Grand Tour. In fact, on that stage 11 in Andorra, which was designed by Joaquim Rodriguez, or partly designed by him, won by Mikel Landa, with Fabio Aru second. Ian Boswell was third, a phenomenal performance by him on the day that his team leader Chris Froome crashed out, or he finished the stage, but it was effectively the end of his Vuelta. He finished the race. Ian Boswell announced that he's got a new two-year contract with Team Sky, and I caught up with him on Monday. He was in Madrid still celebrating the end of his Vuelta with his brother, who'd come over from the States. But I caught up with him on the phone just to hear about how his debut Grand Tour had gone. So here is Ian Boswell. Tremendous race to watch from the outside. What was it like for you to ride it?
It was interesting to do my first Grand Tour, you know, 3 weeks. You know, when you're training and preparing for an event, doesn't seem like all that much time. You know, if you're not fit and you have a race in 3 weeks, you're pretty worried about being prepared for it. Whereas racing 3 weeks is a really long time. You know, sitting here looking back at, you know, Malaga 3 weeks ago, seems like forever ago, and all the stages and, you know, hotels and transfers and everything, you know, it really is quite a daunting task. But no, it was an awesome event, and I actually really got on well with, you know, the Grand Tour racing and kind of the routine of, you know, the daily, you know, habits you kind of develop, you know, with just waking up, you know, eating, riding, getting massage, eating and going to sleep. I kind of really enjoyed that 3 weeks.
You know, you rode extremely well, especially on the so-called hardest stage in Grand Tour history. You were third on that day, which was a bad day for the team in one sense. It was the day that kind of ended Chris Froome's challenge. But what are your recollections of that stage in particular?
For me, that was a good day. And actually, funny enough, when I was up in Isla with Larry Warbass, we're kind of joking around. I was like, "Oh, if I'm going to win a stage, I want to win that one." At the time, I hadn't really seen that it was actually 5,000 meters climbing. So once we actually got the race book, I was a bit taken back. That day for us was, you know, a day that, as far as the team, we're kind of focusing on to, you know, put Froome into the lead. And unfortunately, that went, you know, haywire with his crash. And, you know, I think Nico lost some time that day as well. So as a team, it wasn't a great day. But for myself personally, you know, I slipped into the early move and was kind of able to hang on. And yeah, I guess it was a stage where I built a lot of confidence for the rest of the race, and I guess also for the future.
What would you say was the biggest lesson from riding your first Grand Tour?
I think just the conservation of energy. I had some good talks before the race with Nico Roach, and also with Christian Knees, just about asking them what, you know, how do I best get through this race. And, you know, one thing that Nico told me that, you know, this year in the Tour, he'd never once finished in the peloton.
Wow.
You know, just because when you're there doing playing a role, you know, when your job's done, it's best to conserve for the next days. And actually, Dombrowski was joking with me the first week, because pretty much every day around 10K to go, I would sit up and cruise to the finish. You know, do my job up until that point, but after that, it sort of seemed to be around the 10K marker when my job was done. And just really how much energy you can save and how you can manage your efforts through 3 weeks by, you know, just saving energy when is necessary. And then also just the recovery off the bike, how important that is. And, you know, at Sky we had the new food truck, and, you know, we had nutritionists on race. And I think just really making sure you're looking after yourself once the race is over as well, getting food in right away, and then, you know, having, you know, quality meals when possible makes a big difference at the end of the day.
I mean, they say that riding a Grand Tour changes you as a rider. We're only 24 hours after the finish of the Vuelta, so it's too early to say. But do you feel that, you know, you'll be a different rider after finishing this race?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I think people say, you know, guys have built some endurance. And, you know, I think for me this year, I even noticed a pretty big step up just with doing some harder World Tour races, which I haven't done in the years past, you know, with even just Dauphiné and Tour Poland before this, and then coming into here, just seeing the level that I was able to take with those two races. I think definitely doing, you know, 21 days of consistent racing really will put me at a different level of just kind of maturity physically than I was before I entered.
I saw you mention on Twitter the fact that you had such a specific role every day, and that made the job much easier. Can you elaborate a bit on what that role was and what kind of effect that did have on you, sort of psychologically in particular?
That goes back to when I was talking with Christian Knees before, and, you know, he said that the hardest Grand Tour he's ever done was a Grand Tour where they didn't really have a leader, and he's kind of essentially riding around for 3 weeks, and maybe there's a few stages when you try to go for the break or, you know, do something here or there, but you don't really have a goal. Whereas, you know, like this race, you know, for the first couple of weeks, it was all about helping Froome and keeping the other guys up there as well. And then that changed to Nieve, and then we tried for the team GC. And, you know, every day we set off, you know, with some sort of ambition.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that, you know, for me, really helped just to stay motivated and, you know, keep objectives going forward.
You had a bit of experience with Chris Froome, just won the Tour de France. I guess for you that was a great opportunity to learn from him. But what was he like as a leader as well?
Chris is such a genuine guy. I mean, even this morning he sent me a text and just said, "Congrats on finishing your Grand Tour. It was great to watch." You know, so to get, you know, just comments from a guy like that are, you know, something really nice. And he really is a genuine guy. And, you know, having him at that race, I think, really raises the morale of the whole team. You know, once he left, we were able to get behind Nieve and, you know, help him as best we could. But I think when you have someone like Froome there who, you know, is, you know, on paper maybe the favorite or one of the favorites, you know, he really does bring the team together for, you know, a common goal, and really is able to get the most out of everyone, riders and staff, to give our best effort.
They say, Ian, that Well, I think Charlie Wagelius said that getting a pro contract is easy. Getting a second pro contract is extremely hard. And you've just, I think you announced on Twitter that you've got your second pro contract. You've got another 2 years with Team Sky. When was that deal done, and how, you know, what does that mean to you?
I'm ecstatic to have, you know, another 2 years in the World Tour, but especially on this team. And I guess there's one thing that was kind of always in the back of my mind was an importance of this year was, you know, to secure another contract. But I think just focusing mainly on the performance side of it, I kind of knew that it would hopefully come.
Well, did it hinge on the Vuelta at all, or was it agreed before the Vuelta?
I mean, I'd been in talks with the team prior to the Vuelta, and mm-hmm. I think even the team had kind of released something around the tour saying that they were, you know, likely to re-sign me. But there's a lot of, obviously, not negotiations, but teams hunting for other riders and whatnot. Yeah. And, you know, I wasn't super eager to get it done right away. You know, I figured if I could, you know, kind of prove myself and I fit in really well with this team, that I could be able to stay here. And then on one of the days, I think the time trial day, I was signed the contract. So, I wasn't done till the Vuelta.
You seem to have taken a real step forward this year. Obviously, Tour California as well, you rode extremely well there. You're a climber. How do you see yourself developing as a rider? What kind of rider do you want to become?
I guess it's kind of funny when you look at all the up-and-coming Americans, and most of them, you know, I think just because the Lance Armstrong effect, everyone wants to be a climbing GC rider, and mm-hmm. that's kind of the role that I always aspired to be. And as I've progressed, I guess I've kind of followed that path, as, you know, being climber and potentially, you know, a GC rider if I can spend more time on a time trial bike and improve that. But I think just because of my size as well, you know, I'm not a small guy. I can get skinny if I need to be, but at this point in my career, just to be a valuable teammate, to be able to climb is obviously something that's, you know, rewarding for myself and for the team. But, you know, because I am a bit bigger, I guess to be able to ride the flats in situations when it's needed as well. And I think just to keep progressing and gain as much experience in all, you know, facets of racing.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast, brought to you by Trainer Road, cycling's most effective training tool. Pair your power meter with over 800 workouts and 80 training plans to make you a faster cyclist. Visit trainerroad.com/SPC to try Trainer Road risk-free for 30 days.
Okay, you heard a little extended jingle there for our new partnership, sponsorship from Trainer Road, and we look forward to giving you a bit more information about how that's going to work in the next few weeks. But suffice to say, the three of us, Rob, me and Lionel, are going to be doing our own little program as provided by Trainer Road and updating you as we go along.
It has to be cycling, right? Yeah, we have to do cycling.
It's a cycling, training company, yes, yeah. That's correct, Lionel. Well done, you've been paying attention. A little bit of unfinished business from the Vuelta before we don our film critic hats. If film critics probably don't wear hats because they'd get in the way of other people in the cinema, wouldn't they, sitting behind them? So we'll take off our film critic hats in order to deliver our critiques of the programme, the new Lance Armstrong movie. But a bit of unfinished business from the Vuelta, Rob.
Yes. And it's about that time of year for an Alejandro Valverde, Joaquim Rodriguez spat, isn't it? The World Championships are coming up. They're well known for not getting on at this time of the year. Last day of the Vuelta, should it be a fiesta? Should it be a party? Should it be a day for champagne, or should we say cava in Spain? Should any results change? That's the question, I think, that we should have a look at here, philosophically, because Alejandro Valverde turned up on the final day, finds Joaquim Rodriguez on the start line, who was in the green jersey, and says, "Hang on a minute, mate, I'm going to sprint you today, I'm going to try and get that jersey." Burrito Rodriguez, obviously not known for his sprinting prowess on flat days, he thinks he's earned the jersey, the points jersey. Not very happy about it, and as soon as they cross the line at the end with Alejandro Valverde having just pipped him in the points jersey classification, he says to the media, "Well, I'm not very happy about that. This should be a day to celebrate. This should be a day where I enjoy my day in green. But Valverde's told me, I actually want to thank Alejandro for telling me that the people I'm not happy with are Movistar, and they need to understand that today is a party day."
It's interesting. Actually, Julian on Twitter, at JB888, asked us for a question for the pod. Is it time to change the final stage of Grand Tours and make them competitive? Well, there's nothing, and we've spoken about written rules and unwritten rules. There's absolutely nothing in the rules to say that they shouldn't be competitive. And, you know, if it was just a showcase, there wouldn't be points up for grabs, would there?
Absolutely. There were points on the intermediate sprint, and Movistar and Valverde went for them. The fact that Rodriguez can't sprint for Toffee in those situations is kind of part of the game. And yeah, I mean, it must be annoying, but unfortunately that's the race. It's not over until they cross the finish line. I mean, what if Valverde had been up there in the final sprint finish and got, say, seventh place or something, just one of the minor places? Is that also against the spirit of, you know, of the Grand Tour? No, of course it's not. The race concludes when they cross the finish line at the end of the final stage. In terms of making Grand Tour stages competitive on the final day, I mean, I suppose the only two ways to do that are finish with a time trial, which there's no guarantee that anything will be on the line when you've had 20 days of racing, or finish these Grand Tours on the last mountain stage and have the final stage of the Tour, say, at Alpe d'Huez, or the final stage of the Giro on the Mortirolo, or whatever it happens to be. And I'm not really sure. There's something about, I mean, we've talked about this. When you get to Paris, there's a very strange atmosphere, isn't there? It doesn't feel like the Tour de France anymore. But the race organisers and all the rest of it, part of the business of Grand Tour racing is to showcase the landscapes. And I'm sure the people of Madrid, I mean, they did a fantastic job. It was held at twilight. They lit up all the buildings. Madrid looked fantastic. It looked like the sort of place, certainly, consider booking a sort of weekend break to go and visit. And that's really the point. So, you know, there's a sort of pragmatic answer to this as well. And in the case of the Vuelta, it was competitive right to the last. It wasn't competitive in the sense of the red jersey for the overall leader. But imagine if Dumoulin and Aru had been split by 3 seconds, say, going into the final stage. What would we have seen? Would we have seen Giant Alpecin trying to get him away, trying to force a gap, and see whether they could pull off an incredible, you know.
I mean, that would have been interesting the given the sort of team that, you know, Giant Alpecin had. It would have been highly unusual. But yeah, it would have been interesting, wouldn't it? Or if they'd been split by 1 second, you know, it could have been.
Yeah, if everything is at stake, then there are a lot more permutations to go on the final day of all Grand Tours. Yeah, Champs-Élysées, could we have people putting people into difficulty on the cobbles on the final run into the line? You never know. Interesting point that Rodriguez made to finish his little angry interview as soon as he crossed the line. He said today was a party day, then whatever happens in the World Championships happens. So he's got previous with this, and I think, yeah, I'm in agreement with you there, Lionel. I think racing is racing, isn't it? Let's not forget about that. But because of what's happened in the past, you tend to feel sorry for Purito, I think, because he has had the knife stuck into him a couple of times.
Perennial runner-up. How old is Rodriguez now?
Getting on, mid to late 30s, I would say. 36, 37?
36. Mm. Yeah, he's kind of too many good years
he's
left.
Signed a one-year deal, actually. One man who won't be staying with him is Danny Moreno, who changed agents via a WhatsApp the other week. He sent his agent a WhatsApp. Angel Edo, the former Catalan sprinter, is agent to a lot of Spanish stars, and I know he gave a bit of news that Lionel will be very happy about. Brand new contract, another year, a la Zubeldia.
Well, a lot of comments on Twitter about the way that Zubeldia wrote the Vuelta. He didn't write it very a la Zubeldia at all. And somebody did come up with a very amusing sort of reverse Zubeldia, which was Tom Dumoulin, finishing sixth overall, having not ridden anonymously at all.
The inverted Zubeldia.
Inverted Zubeldia. These are all great T-shirt ideas. You can buy a T-shirt, of course, thecyclingpodcast.com. Go to the shop, and we haven't done any plugging for a while. Let's do another plug. Become a friend of the podcast, £5, thecyclingpodcast.com. We've got 8 specials there, 3 coming up very soon, and they'll be accessible on your mobile phone.
They will, indeed. We should crack on. We've got to. I don't know whether we're going to play the film music, are we?
But I'll get you some popcorn first. I'll go and bring some popcorn in, eh?
Yeah, that'd be great, Rob. Thanks very much. Yeah, the film. So we went to see the programme, the new Stephen Frears film, which is based on David Walsh's book, Seven Deadly Sins. Chris O'Dowd plays David Walsh. Ben Foster plays Lance Armstrong. And it's, well, I think our expectations were fairly low before we went in to see it, from various things that we'd heard, and also the trailer. I don't think did a particularly good job of selling it. And I have to say, I enjoyed it more than I thought, than I expected to enjoy it. But that is not to say that it's a perfect film. I think some things work really well. I think the big flaw is Ben Foster himself. He's not Lance Armstrong, and you know, Armstrong, whatever you think of him, has real presence, a sort of menace about him, charisma, you know, good things and bad things, but mainly a sort of aura. Ben Foster didn't have that. He was a sort of weedy Lance Armstrong.
Well, I was really distracted by just how much like Lance Armstrong.
I mean, he looks like him physically, but there's more to it than looking like physically like somebody.
Definitely, yeah. And I think it's really difficult, isn't it, when you're so familiar with a story, to sort of divorce yourself from what's real and what isn't. I mean, in terms of, you know, it says it's based on the Seven Deadly Sins, but actually a lot of the little detail and stuff seem to come from other books, really, or were revealed first in other books, notably Tyler Hamilton's book and even Emma O'Reilly's book. And so it's a kind of this mashup of all of the various versions of this story that have come out since Lance Armstrong admitted doping. What I found very strange was it was a cycling film. I wasn't expecting a cycling film at all. I was expecting a study of a man's downfall, you know, a tremendous deceitful rise and an incredible downfall, and we didn't get that at all. We got kind of nerdy cycling details. So as a nerdy cyclist, I really enjoyed it. There were a couple of little things that irked me, and at the start I thought we were off to a really rocky start with the depiction of cobbles.
A cobbly start
to Flesh Wallone, which irked me. And as a journalist, I found the scenes of, like, the press room with people standing up and clapping and cheering very odd. I mean, I've never witnessed that myself. I mean, you know, it gave the impression that the press room's like the bleachers at an American football match or something, and it's just not like that. So there were a few little things that irked. But what struck me most was that it was, as I say, it was a story about a cyclist rather than about a man. And the great thing, you know, the sort of Hollywood convention is that the best sports stories are not really sports stories at all. They're stories about people, and so in that sense I can't see it grabbing the mainstream in perhaps the way they imagine. The great Lance Armstrong story will be the one that gets under the skin of the man more than this did.
And this doesn't, I didn't feel, really. There's not an awful lot of character development with Armstrong. It's a race through his life, you know, from his emergence in the mid-90s to his cancer diagnosis, his return, and then seven tours to France are over in the blink of an eye, really. They also use actual footage from the race, which was very interesting, with real commentary, real footage. They sort of mix that up with newly shot stuff, which is as good as that stuff can be. I think it's incredibly difficult to recreate and dramatise cycle racing, or any sport for that matter. It's better than in the Graham O'Brien film, which I think the road racing scenes in that are particularly poorly done, I think. But that's not really a criticism, because I think it's incredibly, incredibly difficult. And so I think that's a good sort of compromise solution. It works quite well in the film. But the Flesh Wallone scene at the start is particularly sort of that's one that you have to look at through the cracks in your fingers, really, isn't it?
Well, I at that point I was braced for an absolute abomination.
Well, your buttocks clenched at that point, Lionel.
I thought this isn't going to get better than this, but it did get better than that. But I think the frustration was that the personal dynamics between the key figures, and the key figures really should have been Armstrong, David Walsh, Betsy Andreu, and Floyd Landis, weren't really explored. They were kind of, we saw a little bit and then we withdrew away. It was like the story didn't really pick one strand and then really explore that, which I think would be would, but it, that would be the hardest way to do it, because that one strand is Armstrong himself, and at the moment that doesn't really exist. Lance Armstrong is probably the only person who really knows the story from that perspective. So to try and dramatise that would be difficult, I think.
You don't really have any sense from the film of why he did it. The Ben Foster character doesn't, as you say, I think an awful lot has gone into the physical resemblance. He looks actually pretty good on a bike, arguably better than Armstrong. He looked pretty good on a bike. I thought they picked actors who actually did look quite convincing on a bike, which is a hard thing to do. I thought Johan Brunell's character was really good, physically resembled him, and had that sort of quiet menace about him, I suppose, if you like. The Dr. Ferrari character was excellent, I thought. Very convincing portrayal, physically looked like him, but there was also just something about him that I found quite convincing.
Yeah, I mean, again, looking at the different angles that they could have chosen, I mean, the journalism aspect wasn't fully explored. We saw those frustrating conversations between David Walsh and his sports editor at the Sunday Times, Alex Butler, who they made Northern. I don't know why. I mean, again, Chris O'Dowd playing David Walsh, because we know David, you know, that's not a particularly good physical likeness. Does that matter at all to the general audience? No, probably not. But we didn't really explore the kind of the difficulty of getting that story. I was kind of expecting, because it had been based on Seven Deadly Sins, a bit more of the kind of Woodward and Bernstein type, you know, furtive conversations. And
but you know, David Miller, I thought, explained very well, you know, the necessity of detaching yourself, divorcing yourself from all the knowledge that you have of the story. That's very hard to do, but I think it's probably necessary. And also, he did a good job, David, I think, of explaining the how filmmaking is necessarily simple, and that it has to make a complicated story as simple as possible. He talks about writing a book as sort of spreading seeds for trees and growing up forests, whereas making a film is like deforestation. You know, it's like getting rid of as much as possible, and you know, that's really hard to do. And
we should explain, really, David Miller was at the little preview showing that we went to, because he was a cycling consultant on the film, and I think he did a good the flesh will own cobbles aside, I think he did a very good job of making all of that cycling look authentic. The problem I think they had was exactly what you said, Richard. They chose to tell the full story from, you know, pre-cancer through to the downfall, and that's just too much of the story. And you did get the sense that you kind of whipped through it, ticking things off as we went. Oh, that's the third win, fourth win, fifth win. And because of that, it had that slight feel of a kind of Channel 5 daytime film that they'll put on just before Neighbours or something. You know, it didn't feel like something you would go to the cinema to see. I don't know.
Neighbours on Channel 5 now. So, finally, we've got to wrap things up. But marks out of 10.
For entertainment's value, I'd give it a good solid 8, because I actually enjoyed it a hell of a lot more than I expected. I expected it to be dreadful. Not because Stephen Frears is a very fine director. The story is incredibly compelling, but I just think the best sports stories are always the ones that you don't necessarily know very well.
And you zoom in on, as you say, the little details. Less is more. I think they've tried to do too much with it, but I will give it a solid 7, I think. So anyway, we better wrap things up. Thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
And thank you, Rob. I believe you're off to Berlin to see our erstwhile colleague, Daniel Freib. It's a Home of Cycling tour to Berlin. Do give him our best, and maybe you can pick up some audio. Maybe you and he can do a little bit of podcasting on the road for us.
I'm going to try and bring him back, because I'm sick of doing washing up, so we'll see.
Are you taking a bag big enough for his hair?
I don't know if he's had it cut. Yeah,
stuff that into some kind of small bag. Anyway, have a good time in Berlin, Rob, and hopefully you'll be able to join us again very soon.
I look forward to it. Cheers.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.